The Pushcart Prize is one of the most venerable institutions in American publishing. It's been going strong on a shoestring since 1976.
And I asked a lot of people to help me, because all I was a fired editor and a failed novelist. So I asked Anais Nin and Joyce Carol Oates, and Ishmael Reed, Ralph Ellison, all these people. There are about 20, I think. And amazingly, I typed these letters on an old Olivetti manual, which I still love, 2 pages, single-spaced, and I sent out about maybe 50 letters to every author I thought would help me. And they came through amazingly.
That's Pushcart Press founder and editor Bill Henderson. Then Trump just proposed a massive increase to an already bloated military budget, while proposing huge cuts to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and funding for the environment. How did the Pentagon budget get so bloated? We'll talk with Eric Lindorf about the massive Pentagon accounting fraud he exposed that's part of the reason military spending just keeps going up. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When Bill Henderson established the Pushcart Prize back in 1976, he'd recently been fired from his job at Doubleday. He'd also had his novel rejected multiple times. Henderson didn't know that the crazy idea he had to publish the best of poetry, short fiction, and essays published in the small presses over the previous year was going to take off so spectacularly. All he knew was that he didn't like the profit-driven mandates of the traditional publishing industry. The Pushcart Press has been going now since 1979, and along the way, Henderson has published and self-published a passel of books, among them several memoirs. Bill Henderson happens to be my neighbor, so I invited him over to talk about Pushcart Press, about writing and publishing, and about his memoir, All My Dogs, A Life. Bill Henderson, it's such an honor to have you here on Writer's Voice.
I'm very happy to be here.
You know, I've certainly known about Pushcart Press for a very long time, but little did I know that you live so close to here in this Springs neighborhood of East Hampton, which both of us love so much. So it's really an honor not only to talk with you, but also to read in your books about this beautiful, beautiful place. So I wanted to start with you about your memoir, All My Dogs. This is one of a number of memoirs that you've done, but really a wonderful, charming one. You call it a dog-human memoir. You say you can't live without dogs. Why not?
Unconditional love, I guess. It's the heart of all religion and all dog lovers. You don't get anything like the love of a dog, especially a good dog. There are dogs who are not so loving, but I just love my dogs. I had 14 of them so far, and they're great companions. They're funny. They're all different. They all have their characters. They have their likes, their dislikes. They're like humans. I hate to insult them by saying they're like humans, but they remind me of very different characters.
They're people to you.
They are people, and they're smart people, and because they're not befuddled by language, you can perhaps even have a better conversation with them and have come to a better understanding than if you're messing around with a lot of words, which just tend to confuse us.
Yeah, and that's such an interesting thing for you to say, though. You're someone who has made your life publishing the words of others and writing your own words.
Well, words try to get us somewhere. They always fail. They try. The same as music, the same as art. We're trying to get to somewhere spiritual, somewhere that's meaningful, hugely meaningful to us. And words are an attempt. They often fail, and they often ruin us or exhilarate us, too. But, we have to be careful with words, but I'm, of course, addicted to words.
Well, before we get back to words, I'm going to ask you a little bit about your dogs that you talk about in this wonderful memoir, All My Dogs, Bill Henderson. Your first dog was Trixie, and you say that she taught you how to play. Now, you were a child at this time. Why would a child, you, need a dog to teach them how to play?
Well, I grew up in a very fundamentalist family. I mean, sweet, sweet people, my mother and my father, but there were a lot of strict rules, and of course, God was watching over your shoulder every second of your life, and life was extremely serious, and your permanent record was always out there, and either Santa Claus was keeping it, or Peter Rabbit, or God himself was looking on. And to play with abandon like a dog, like Trixie did, with a little hard rubber ball we used to throw around the room, was just a wonderful thing to see an animal in love with play and not have any rules, you know, such as Mary Oliver spoke of in her poem about, you have only to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. And that's what Trixie was to me.
Yes, that's so beautiful and such a wonderful poem. I mean, Mary Oliver herself was a great lover of dogs.
I know. In fact, one of her final books was a collection of dog poems. A pretty good volume, I thought. Yeah.
Yeah, so growing up in a family that was fundamentalist, I mean, you didn't live as a fundamentalist for most of your life, but you have a profound kind of spiritual note that's not heavy-handed. In fact, it's barely there, but it's there. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, I like to think my parents were very loving, too, but of course they were all tied up in a church which had thunderous pronouncements about going to hell and such things, and I don't know why they couldn't tune that out, but it was always there. But I think the fact that love is so important, empathy for other people is so important. These are Christian virtues. I just wish more Christians would pay attention to them. And that's what I try to do in the Pushcart Prize and all my books, is attempt to reach out to characters in the book, the authors, and to something beyond the mere publish. I don't publish books for money. I used to be an editor at Doubleday, but I found myself very uncomfortable at Doubleday because we always had to keep an eye on the budget and making millions of dollars. And we had offices at 277 Park Avenue, big offices. We were the largest publishing company in the world, 750 books a year Doubleday published. But we had to show a reason, financial reason, for why you wanted to publish any book as an editor you wanted to bring out. No matter if you loved it to tears, that wasn't enough. It had to make money.
And you were fired by Doubleday. Why was that?
Well, it was justly, because I was obviously a misfit. The only thing, a really good thing I did there was start the publishing softball league, the publisher softball league, and we had a great time. We invited the mailroom, and girls could play, and we had picnics in Central Park, and didn't care. I think we lost every game except for one, and that was because they didn't show up. But after a year and a half, 2 years of that, and I wasn't producing, making money for Nelson Doubleday, who later sold Doubleday and bought the Mets, so you can see where his heart was, not in books. And now Doubleday is just a shadow of what it was. They're hitched up in a kind of a very odd marriage with Knopf, which is the Doubleday Knopf imprint, which is just so screwy. And very strange, and an accountant's dream, I suppose. But in the old days, Doubleday was a money-making machine, and I was supposed to be part of that machine, and boy, did I not feel good about that.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with founder and publisher of the Pushcart Press, Bill Henderson. So you left Doubleday. How old were you? Where were you? And how did that lead to Pushcart Press?
Well, I'm a kind of a sneaky guy. I am determined. Actually, I went to work for Putnam's for a brief time, and I realized that this is just not going to work. And in one summer in 1975, I rented a house in Southampton, a little cabin, and decided somehow that I was going to start something called the Pushcart Prize. Now, we have to back up here a bit because I'd already published a book and should have been fired for that. It was called the Publish It Yourself Handbook, in which people like Nan Leonard and Virginia Woolf, Stuart Brand, and other people talked about how they started their own publishing companies to publish what they damn well pleased, and to hell with the big boys and the commercial and the vanity presses, by the way. I am no fan of vanity presses, modern vanity presses, or the old-time vanity presses, which were absolute frauds and took a lot of money from unsuspecting authors. So the Publish Yourself Handbook was published from a little in 1973. I registered the press with the Yonkers, New York Chamber of Commerce, and a Better Business Bureau, whatever it was, in 1972. So that was the start of Pushcart Press. The Publish Yourself Handbook came out of nowhere in this one-room studio apartment, which my then-wife and I were jammed into because we had no money. And it sold eventually 75,000 copies, just by word of mouth, because it was a book whose time had come. Authors were furious about the money makers were the only way they could get their books into print. If it wasn't going to make a dime, they weren't going to see print. They would never see readers. And backing up even further, back in 1970, I had published my own first novel. And I realized that you don't need commercial publishers. I'd been rejected for 10 years. And I had been writing it for most of 10 years, too. And I'd put my whole life into this thing. I was almost 30 years old. It was called The Kid That Could. I still love this novel. I think it's terrific. Not many other people do, but it's terrific. They think it's mysterious. Publishers Weekly said it was might have a cult following, but they couldn't figure it out either. I know exactly what it's about. It's about a kid trying to figure out how to live in America. With ideals and also with the immense need for practicality. Are you going to be idealistic, going to be practical, one or the other, and instead of this hybrid mix we all try to get through with? But that book sold 75,000 copies. And my wife and I then had about $20,000 in the bank, which was pretty good. And we decided that I was on vacation from at that time Putnam in Berkeley, California, at the Mediterranean Cafe. I think they have a table over there with my name on it. I don't know. It just hit me, the Pushcart Prize, and why not try to bring some of these presses who'd read the publishers out, the people, and give them some honor, some credit, and put together an anthology. And I asked a lot of people, that's what I was sitting by the bay in Southampton doing, to write to a lot of people to help me, because all I was a fired editor and a failed novelist. So I asked Anais Nin and Joyce Carol Oates, bless her, she's wonderful, Ishmael Reed, Ralph Ellison, the list goes on and on.
Buckminster Fuller. I have a list here. Wait a second. Buckminster Fuller, Paul Bowles.
Mm-hmm. And all these people, they're about 20, I think. And amazingly, I typed these letters on an old Olivetti manual, which I still love. I hate the electric crap. Two pages, single-spaced, and I sent out about maybe 50 letters to every author I thought would help me. And they came through amazingly. I expected nothing. I had no credentials to present to them. But they thought it was a damn good idea to have a Pushcart Prize, which would celebrate the small presses of the country. And now it's become the small presses of the world. We get nominations from Japan, Indonesia, South Africa, India, Germany, England, all around. And thanks, I guess, to the web, which I wish would go away. But anyway, we now are kind of a worldwide prize and get 8,000 nominations a year. But it all started, bless them, with those founding editors who said, this Henderson has a good idea, let's go with it. And I did. And it was just so lucky for all of us that The editor of the New York Times Book Review was a fellow named Harvey Shapiro, who recently died a couple of years ago. He became a good friend. But he didn't know me from nowhere. But he was a poet who was published his whole life in small presses. So when he heard this coming down the pike, he jumped on it and said he was going to give it major review attention. And every year for many, many years, he did. Not only reviews in the Times Book Review, but features often in the same issue. It was phenomenal the way the so-called evil commercial publishing establishment rose to this book, to the Pushcart Prize, including Publishers Weekly. And Tom Lass gave it its first, L-A-S-K, gave it his first mention in a feature in the Daily Times right out of nowhere. It was phenomenal, and I had not expected it. I was completely abashed. I didn't think I could pull this off. I had absolutely no, as I said, I was among my, very unworthy among people, far worthier than me. But it happened, and it's been gone for 44 years now. And it means something to people.
And why do you think that it got so much acclaim from the very industry that it stood in not opposition, but in contrast to?
Well, I think many of the people in the industry, in the publishing, well, are good, generally very good people. They're not out for a buck individually, most of them. I mean, they have to make money to keep the company going. But most of them were authors, wanted to be authors when they were in college. They studied literature. Their heart was in the word. But here they were stuck in a commercial world, and I think they were as torn as I had been at Doubleday, and they sprang to this. They really thought this is something that I need personally in this commercial outfit I'm in here, whether it's a Times Book Review or Publishers Weekly or a Library Journal or all the critics around the country too. Most of us still are frustrated writers, and I didn't know this. I didn't know what would happen. I didn't know if I would even find enough stuff in the small press world to make an anthology in the first edition. But it was there, and boy, is it there now. That's the history. And that's the start, and where we are now is a flourishing of over 44 years of terrific writing. And a lot of junk, too. Wherever there's publishing, there's junk and vanity. But it's just what happened with the Pushcart Prize is it came out of nowhere and swept me along, and I'm still being swept.
So do you think that the Pushcart Prize, in fact, has been an important factor in the development, you know, the flourishing of the small press today?
I wouldn't want to take any credit personally. But I know there's a movement, and if we've helped a little bit, that's good, by giving recognition to these presses. 800 presses made nominations for the last Pushcart Prize, and we've justified them, I think, by presenting to the world what really, really good stuff, poetry, essays, short stories, memoirs, are in these presses, which for so long, just given the backhand of our national literature, they're nothing. They're just people in their basements and grinding out stuff. And I would like to think we had something to do with giving dignity to these out-of-the-way presses who weren't making any money, weren't getting big splashy reviews or big splashy features, didn't have money to advertise. And I would like to think that the reason there is so much great literature now, too much to put in the Pushcart Prize, has something to do with the Pushcart Prize. But it has to do with a lot of other things, too, but the will and the spirit, particularly the spirit of authors, not to be denied by commercial concerns, and to let their spirit soar. And sometimes you wish maybe they would put the stuff in a drawer and let it sit for 5 years before they published it. But it's so much better now than it was in 1976 when the first edition came out. And of course, we had the Beats before that, we had mimeographed stuff. But now it's a genuine movement. And if anything, I feel sorry for now, it's the commercial presses who have such a hard time making a buck and competing with the internet and all the technology that's being thrown at them. And they're collapsing together like skyscrapers because they can't stand up alone anymore. There are only five giant commercial publishers now, and they all have all these subsidiaries or imprints who used to be outstanding presses on their own. But they're having a hard time. God knows if Barnes & Noble goes down the tubes, the whole thing's going to collapse. So it's a shaky ground. But I am so happy to see that independent stores are coming back. Emails, damn them, are disappearing. Emails, e-books are disappearing. Emails can go too, by the way. Get a stamp and put it on a letter and say something. Take your time. I do email too, I must admit. But e-books are fading. And 5 years ago, you were sworn that there were going to be no more physical books anymore. It was all going to be emails. Everybody was saying the book is done. That's ridiculous. And I'm so, well, that was scary. But it turns out the book is not done. It's coming back. Independent bookstores have not been wiped out by Amazon. I hate to say that word, but independent bookstores are coming back, and the book and the independent bookstore are back. They're here, and we're not going anywhere.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with founder and publisher of the Pushcart Press, Bill Henderson.
So why do you think that's true? Why did the ebook, in fact, seems to be fading away? Not entirely, but it certainly hasn't grown much. In fact, I think it's lessened, and the independent bookstores as well. What does this say about the way we read and the way we take in information?
Well, I just think there's a blowback, for lack of a better word, that people are sick of looking at things on screens. I can't imagine trying to read a novel on a screen. I can barely look at my computer, which my wife gave to me last year for the first time. The glare hurts my eyes, for one thing. How can you stare at those things all day and try to read a novel? It's just beyond me. And to hold a book in your hand, to smell the book, to put it on your library shelf if you love it, and to see it there every day is a wonderful thing. You walk into a room and the books are books that you love. They're there. They're not hidden away in some damn gadget. And by the way, the gadgets are going to disappear, as we know, because they disappear every year and a new gadget comes along. So if your book is on a gadget, you're not going to be able to read it in 5 years, let alone 1,000 years. And books I publish, I would like to think, hopefully, foolishly, that they will be here 1,000 years from now for people to appreciate, because a book is like that. And that's why we have books from 2,000, 3,000 years ago. It's an amazing thing that people have. I think they're just sick of looking at screens, for one thing.
So now, back to the dogs.
Okay.
Your next dog after Trixie was Duke. And you say in the book, in your memoir, All My Dogs, Bill Henderson, you say that Duke began to teach you what you needed to remember and would forget and remember again decades later. And then you don't explain that. Now, maybe this is a long time since you wrote that memoir. Maybe you don't remember now, but I'm going to ask you, what did you mean by that?
Well, I think just the joy of our walks together, and how this was everything. It wasn't crammed in a room with your school books trying to do homework and worried about A's and B's and the honor roll and getting into college and girls. Although Duke was not fixed, so he had a thing about girls, too. In fact, he would disappear for days, and I got very scared that something happened to him, but he'd always come back. I think that was about girls. But just that natural buoyancy, that joy. And I have a hard time even today. It's a gloomy day today. And I look at my dog, and he's old Charlie's his name, my current dog, a mutt, got from the rescue, came out of Puerto Rico, rescued from Puerto Rico. And I say, squirrel. And he's out. He looks like he's sound asleep, and he's out like a shot. Squirrel! He's not sleeping. He's just ready to hear squirrel. He's out looking for a squirrel. Always, always there in the moment.
Yeah. Now, you and I spoke yesterday, and as we're talking here, this is a week in which a friend of yours lost one of his dogs to drowning, and you yourself lost two dogs to drowning near here. Tell us what happened.
Well, I let the dogs out. In those days, as you remember, around here used to be very few houses. So my wife and I let the dogs run outside. There were no cars, especially in the winter. There was nobody around. And they apparently disappeared into the woods. And somebody was building a spec house, which means it's on speculation. And they had to put a pool in the backyard. And I had gone away for the night and came back early in the morning. And they'd been out before. And they weren't there. And we called and we got a bullhorn. We went through the woods calling Rocky and Ellen. They were our first dogs when we were first moving in together, both of them mutts. And it turns out a week later, they were found in this spec house swimming pool. They'd come out on the tarp to drink some water. The tarp had not been nailed down. The fence had not been put up around the swimming pool as is required. And the tarp just slid into the water, and they went with it and drowned. It was the most horrible, horrible thing that had ever happened to me, one of the most. And it was just, it was absolutely devastating. And my wife decided she didn't ever want to have another dog again. But I'd been out walking in the park nearby, and the warden of the park had a cage full of outdoors of puppies, yellow labs. I just happened to see them walk by. This is before all this happened. And they were so cute, so wonderful. These little, little yellow lab puppies, the most endearing thing you're ever going to see. So I told Jeannie, listen, I'm just going to go have a look at those. She said, you're not going to bring home a dog. Put your money away. And so I said, okay, good. But I put a check in my pocket, sneaked in my pocket, and went over and brought home for $50 and Sophie. And we called her Sophie because she was overstuffed like a sofa. And she just changed our lives. And we went on to have a baby and a wonderful child and recovered.
Yeah, in fact, it recovered your relationship, which had kind of been on the rocks before then.
It was, yeah. Sophie was like our first child, perhaps, but it's what we had in common. And when it got rough between us, we still had Sophie. And then after that, we had our baby, Lily. So it all worked out beautifully. And now we have two twin grandsons. So, yeah.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Bill Henderson, founder and publisher of Pushcart Press. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Bill Henderson of the Pushcart Press, publisher of the yearly anthology, The Pushcart Prize. It brings together some of the best writing from small presses and magazines each year. Henderson lives around the corner from me in East Hampton, New York, but he also has a summer house in Maine. You joined a congregation there in Maine, and you write in this book, in this memoir, All My Dogs, about your dog, Lulu. You and Lulu both contracted breast cancer at the same time, and you got a call from the minister of the congregation in Maine who told you that the congregation was praying for you. And then you had a remarkable experience after that.
Well, one would like to think that this was not real. Lulu and I were in the sun porch of our house here, and I got a call from a friend up there who said that the congregation had prayed for me. And I thought that was very sweet of them, very nice, because I'd gone through three surgeries for this thing, which blessedly is 12 years in the past now. And Lulu had got some lumps on her chest, and the doctor told me it looked like cancer. But I had breast cancer at the same time, which is kind of odd for a man, not rare, but it's unusual. My mother had breast cancer. My sister had breast cancer. So it was my turn. And all of a sudden in this room, this strength came to the room, just this kind of, it wasn't kind of sympathy. It was the spirit of real strength, of real, just, it made me feel strong. And it came out of nowhere. I didn't know what it was, but it was really real. That was the presence of whatever you want to call it, the Holy Spirit. Forget the word God, it's overused. But something was in that room with my poor dog and me. And it came right after that the word of the prayer that the minister in Maine had made for me. I later had the opportunity to publish a book for him, too. But that's another story.
It's so hard for people to talk about experiences like that. You know, even when I asked you, there was a little look in your face like, do I really want to talk about this? And I've certainly had the same experience, a force of love that's absolutely palpable and real and, you know, just as real as the microphone I'm talking into. Why do you think it's so hard for us to talk about that?
Well, I don't talk about cancer. There's a lot of cancer out there in the world. And I think it's probably hard because people look at you like you're some kind of religious nut. And the sense of force or the sense of love, here we go. You're going to be born again with me or something, which I am not, although I do preach sermons at my little church right around the corner from time to time, although I am completely unfrocked. Little Presbyterian church with beautiful people. And another time this happened was with my daughter in the cabin in the house. I actually built a house in Maine once. And I bounced her head against the wall and had a horrible headaches. And we went to a wall I built out of hard pine, not any soft wallboard stuff for me, manly pine. And I thought she was dying, and we went to, because she had horrible headaches. She was 6, 7 years old, I believe. And we went to the local clinic, and he said, rush her to the hospital up in Ellsworth and have a CAT scan. And I thought, oh, my God, my daughter is dying because I had to build this strong wall and that I'm responsible and I was really going to kill myself. If she died, that was it. I was going to go where she was. I didn't care. I was doing 80 miles an hour to get to the hospital and the CAT scan, and the whole world ballooned into this feeling of grace, of love, this surrounding me and my daughter and my wife. Totally inappropriate, you know. You're panicking, and you're thinking of killing yourself, and this grace descends from nowhere, out of nowhere. It couldn't have been expected. And that, what I would call, is a genuine religious experience from nowhere, from somewhere else that you don't expect. And that, and this force that came into the room with Lulu and me when she had the breast cancer, the dog, and was dying, and I was supposedly dying too, was something else. Those are two great spiritual experiences, which I cannot deny. You can twist them and turn them all you want, but they came from somewhere else.
You wrote another memoir about your cancer called Cathedral, An Illness and a Healing. You've written how many memoirs now?
Oh, it's terrible. I'm the memoir junk king. I'm 6 memoirs published by Faber & Faber, for Strauss, Simon & Schuster, Godin. Good old David Godin did all my dogs, and Norton published one. And Cathedral, the most recent book I published from Pushcart with Norton. So there's been 6. I can't shut up about my life, I guess. It's a very boring life. I don't know why anybody would want to read about it, but people have bought the books enough to the publishers come forward and do them. But Cathedral's about. I often thought my little place near the tower in the cabin in Maine needed a holy place or a sacred place on it. It needed indeed a little chapel. So I found a rock outcropping and I built a stone cathedral there. But it wasn't finished for many years because I had this, the cancer came on, and it was a struggle just to get it done. I was weak from chemo. And so I did do it, and fighting through the cancer and the chemo and the treatments and the depression and everything. I got my little cathedral built, and then I wrote a book about it.
So what makes a good memoir, and what are some of the guideposts or guidelines that you use in writing your six memoirs?
It's very simple. I don't start to write a book unless I cry first. If something gets to me so that I just can't stop crying, that means that is really special to me. I don't sit down with a paper and pencil and try to figure out, what can I write about now? I'm supposed to be a writer. Why don't I write something? No, it's got to hit you right in the gut, like grace coming from the sky or wherever it came from, and the force that came into the room. It's got to be something that is in you overwhelmingly, or else don't bother to bother other people with your jottings, you know. And so that's the reason that's how I figure out what I'm going to try and write about. I wrote a book about hymns, too, because I found myself in the little church right around the corner here in East Hampton, bathed in tears. I'm singing some of these great old hymns from my childhood. And I said, okay, Henderson, there it is. You're going to write a book about great hymns. And it took me 5 years, but I just read every hymn in the Presbyterian hymn book and picked out the ones that I thought were really terrific and wrote about them. The history, like Amazing Grace, and He Lives is another one. There's so many, and a whole list of hymns that I like but didn't like good enough to put in the book. So that was published by Simon & Schuster. But again, it was something that obviously meant something to me because physically I was having a reaction to it. So that was Simple Gifts, it's called. It's still in print from Simon & Schuster, Simple Gifts, about hymns in our life. And Simple Gifts is, of course, a great Shaker hymn, too. But
I think that's my favorite hymn. Yeah. "'Tis a gift to be simple."
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah. So now, in the most recent Pushcart Prize book, which you have in your hand here, wonderful, you know, kind of the cream of the crop. Mm-hmm. Tell us about maybe one of your favorite stories in the book.
Well, that's something I try to avoid. Mm-hmm. Every year I've written an introduction, and I never or almost never mention particular works in the book because there are 60 or more. And I don't want to leave anybody out. I never talk about it in the introduction. I just say how great these presses are, how great these stories are, and on and on like that. But you got me here. I will tell you the story by Pam Houston, which is the first story in the book, What Has Irony Done For Us?
Yes, yeah. And I that is just a phenomenal story.
It is. And once again, not to beat it to death, it's about a dog dying. And there's never been, I don't think, as I can remember, there have been thousands of stories in the Pushcart Prize over 44 years. I can't remember an all-dog story. I'm sure there have been a few. But this is about her dog, an Irish wolfhound, I think, and his last days out there in Colorado. And how horrible it was to her to see him dying, falling apart, and having to put him down. Now, any dog owner knows this is absolutely excruciating. For some people, they can't even have a dog because they can't go through that pain again of watching the dog go. And I've been through it many times, and it never gets any easier. It's totally overwhelming, and I'm still thinking of my dog, my favorite dog, Lulu. And I look at her picture, and I tear up. And Lulu's been dead for over 10 years, longer, 15 years. But this story by Pam Houston about the death of her dog is... I sat there. In Maine, I go to a farmer's market and sell books. I have a little bookstore up there, too, in Sedgwick, Maine. And I was sitting there reading through the Pushcart Prize, which is on the table for sale. And I started to read this story again. And I was bawling. And I think many people have had the same reaction to Pam's story. It's just that, I would think, is one of the most moving stories in the Pushcart Prize. There are about 30 others, memoirs and essays, that are equally as important and equally as strong. But for sheer emotional punch in the gut, don't read this story.
It's about, and more than the death of the dog as well, it's kind of a book that references the mourning, the losses that we, so many of us are feeling, I feel every day, of our connection to the natural world, how the natural world is being affected around us. I mean, her dog was so much a reminder of being here now in the natural world. So it was making that connection between the personal tragedy and the, you know, the existential tragedy that we think about and that we feel so personally.
Oh, God, it is an oh, God moment. It's all slipping away at a rocket speed. And when you miss your dog, when you see a dog die, and its innocence, for one thing, it's the innocence of the animal who was so kind and loving and didn't deserve to die after 10 years, you know, and so unsuspecting. It's a childish innocence, and not even childish, just plain innocence. And it hurts, and it hurts to see what the world does to innocent people. We have now millions of people without homes and a president who has fun beating them up. And the climate, of course, is horrifying what's happening at a very rapid speed. I just talked to a fellow named Reverend Billy on the phone this morning who talks about anti-consumerism, has a great group, great, great sermons. And we both discussed the fact that it's not in 100 years this is going to happen. This is like 2 years. It's not even 2030, which they're bringing it back to. It's like tomorrow. And that kind of what we have done to this innocent world, or at least a world not deserving of it, is beyond sinful. Up in Maine, my wife and I have gone there for 25 years, and there never been a tick. Never a tick anywhere. We live amidst of some blueberry fields, and we figured, well, the ticks will never get across the fields. They're there now. There are massive amounts of ticks. They're coming north in scads. They're even killing moose in northern Maine because in the winter ticks, they swarm over the moose. They bleed them dry, and the moose can't get enough food, so it dies in the winter from winter ticks. This is climate change. This is the warmth that's moving. We haven't had any snow this winter here. We had one blast of cold air a couple of days ago. That was it. And I don't think we're going to see snow here again. And last summer in Maine, it was hot. It was 94 degrees on July 4th when I was up there. And all the week of August, all the month of August, it was in the 80s. It's never been in the 80s in Maine. It's always in the 70s, low 70s. We used to have fires in the fireplace at the cabin. And I never turned on, never laid a fire last summer. The water temperature, according to the Portland Herald, it was 5 degrees hotter than it had been the year before. If it gets 5 degrees hotter this summer, we're not going to have any lobsters, for one thing. They're going to head to Canada. And the whole thing's going to collapse. So this is a real emergency. And anybody who says this is not happening is nuts. Another angle is, I've heard, well, it's not our concern. This is a religious, evangelical, perhaps, thing. God is in control of the climate. We don't have anything to say about it. It's up to God. Well, that's another nail in the corpse of some religious doctrine.
Yes, and so much of the work that I'm seeing these days from small presses. I went on the site of the Sun magazine.
Sun is great.
Yeah, and I noticed how much of the environmental work that they're publishing. So it feels like the consciousness is shifting. Let's just hope it's in time.
Yeah, it's about time. And I think it is happening. Because you don't see Paradise, California burn down and think, well, there's another fire in California. I had a friend in Paradise. I've been to Paradise, which, by the way, is named for Pair of Dice, not Paradise. one of the founding editors of the Pushcart Prize, he's dead now, Len Fulton, had his offices in Paradise. It was called Dust Books. And I went to visit him in Paradise. So, I know Paradise and the hurricanes and, you know, it's just pretty obvious what's happening. Now, if I can put in a plug for my wife's book, A Day Like Any Other, The Hurricane of 1938, it's a great novel. It was published just in August. And it's about a huge hurricane that came here in 38 and how it devastated and killed 1,000 people up the East Coast. And it's going to happen again, only this time there are a lot more people out here in East Hampton on Long Island, and there's going to be a lot of more people killed if another hurricane comes, and it's going to come, mm-hmm. if you see what's been happening around the country, yeah. because of warming oceans and the storms are getting stronger and stronger.
So this is the question that so many of us interviewers, I've noticed I'm not the only one, mm-hmm. ask at moments like this. Yeah. What gives you hope?
My dog. I would like to think that we have somewhere in us the resilience not to kill ourselves. Mm-hmm. I think back in 1984 when Lily was born, our baby girl. This was the time when Reagan was going to blow up on the world. He was threatening to build bigger and bigger atomic bombs. And it looked like, this is when a book called The Fate of the Earth was published. And everybody thought it could really happen in a second. There were bumper stickers, a nuclear war could ruin your whole day. And they were in the back of cars. This is the year my daughter was born. And I always thought then, we don't commit suicide. We're not that stupid that we commit suicide. Well, I guess it worked. I mean, I guess we didn't kill ourselves then. But we better get really, really hopping to do this now. Because the thing now is not a bomb that's going off. It's slow, slow death that you can ignore any time you like to feel like it. But it's happening, and it's happening quicker and quicker, and it's becoming like a bomb.
Well, Bill Henderson, this has just been a fascinating conversation about a number of your books, including All My Dogs, that memoir, another memoir, Cathedral, An Illness and a Healing, the Publish It Yourself Handbook, and, of course, the Pushcart Prize. And this is the 2019 edition where you mentioned that wonderful story by Pam Houston. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's a real honor to be with you.
Bill Henderson, founder and publisher of Pushcart Press. President Trump released his $4.75 trillion budget proposal this week. It calls for massive cuts to three social programs he promised he wouldn't cut during his campaign: Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. His proposal would slash $25 billion out of Social Security, $845 billion out of Medicare, and $1.5 trillion out of Medicaid, the program that provides health care to 20% of all Americans. Trump's budget also called for massive cuts to programs aimed at reducing global warming. But the president also proposed a $750 billion budget for the Defense Department, an increase of 5% over the already bloated budget he got last year. Back in December, I interviewed Eric Lindorf of The Nation magazine for my home station WPKN out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. He wrote an exposé of the Pentagon's $21 trillion accounting fraud. The $21 trillion that were disappeared, some hidden in secret slush funds, became justification for the Pentagon's annual budget ask, propelling U.S. military spending higher year after year. Lindorf was put on the trail of the fraud by Pentagon whistleblower Chuck Spinney. I asked Eric Lindorf how the $21 trillion accounting scam worked.
What was really shocking about this is what the Pentagon has been doing is, for all these years, they've been using what the Pentagon itself, inside the Pentagon, the jargon is they call them plugs, because they plug numbers in that are not real just to make the books balance. And basically what they're doing is they have to make the beginning statements in their financial statements for a given year match the ending figures for the prior year. And they do this without any regard to actual expenditures or actual income. But you can see where the problem is. If you keep doing that and you're making fake numbers that make it look like you're spending more money than you actually did spend, things get more and more out of whack. from year to year. So they're making up all these numbers. And the game is twofold. One is, and I was told this on the record and off the record by different people in the Pentagon operation, former people that worked there in it, like Jack Armstrong or Chuck Spinney, and people that can't be named because they're still working there, who said, you know, one of the goals is to make the budget completely indecipherable and impossible to analyze. And the other goal is that by making it look like they spent all the money that was appropriated the prior year and turning in those financial statements for the current year and the prior year, when they make their budget request for the next fiscal year, Congress looks at it and says, oh, they spent all this money, we need to give them more. And so the budget has sort of a built-in escalator that it goes up and up without any justification.
So actually, they're getting billions of dollars. Actually, they get 54 cents out of every dollar in federal appropriations. This is money that, you know, could be spent on infrastructure, let's say, or fighting climate change, schools, housing, and health care.
Everything we need. Did you see the quote from Eisenhower that I put at the end of the report? It was an amazing quote that I found Eisenhower had said at the start of his first term, not the famous letter he wrote, the farewell letter, where he warned about the military-industrial complex. And when he was first coming in, he said, you know, that all this money that gets spent on the military, we need to remember, is being stolen from the things that people really need, which are, you know, schools and hospitals and, you know, roads and all the other things we need. And he was really right. I mean, he was making, you know, a sad statement about the reality of America in the 50s. And it's even more true now.
So what actually is happening to that money? Is just being piled up in budgets to fund what?
Well, what Chuck Spinney and others told me is that it gets pushed into slush funds. Totally illegally and unconstitutionally, they shove it into other categories where it doesn't get spotted. And there's a history of this. It was done. Spinney actually was involved in exposing it during the Reagan administration years. Remember, I don't know how old you are, but there was really high inflation during the 80s, especially in the first Reagan term. And so what the Pentagon started doing and continued till they got caught was putting in an extra amount in anything they requested in their budget to account for inflation. But their inflation allowance was 30%. And inflation never got over about 14%, even at the worst during that high inflation period. So what they did then was pocket the difference that they didn't spend in their estimates of the inflation adjustment. And it piled up to be about ultimately, $100 billion or so over a pretty quick short time. And they put it in something that was ambiguously named a merged surplus account. And Spinney says that he and some of the other whistleblowers who were looking into this and calling it out publicly found evidence that it went into the Iran-Contra campaign to fund illegally a secret army fighting to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua after Congress had banned the use of any funds to do that.
So this money is going into slush funds where it can be used in ways that are not accountable or public, on the public record. Also, how much does this contribute to, let's say, a kind of inflation in the defense industry itself?
Well, of course it contributes. The Pentagon spends about $350 billion a year on the arms contractors. It's more than a third of the entire defense budget is going into the arms industry. And the money can go into areas that the least accountable parts of that are what are called contractor support funds. I'm told that that's where the accounting gets really funky. In fact, it's so funky that there was a report that came out last February that the Air Force said that they couldn't tell how Lockheed Martin was spending its contractor support funds for the F-35 project, which is the $1.5 trillion most expensive weapon system ever created by man. So they can't tell how they send the money to Lockheed, but they can't tell what they're doing with it. And the contractor support funds are rising so high now that the Air Force said they were going to probably have to cut their order of F-35s by a third, which is a disaster, because when you cut the number of planes you order, but the contract is capped so that it goes to the contractor no matter how many they build, it means the cost per plane goes up by 50%. So already the plane costs something like $130 million per plane for a fighter plane. And so if it could easily rise to $200 million per plane if they cut back the order.
So David Lindorf, in this article about massive accounting fraud at the Defense Department, you say that this kind of slippery bookkeeping and fraudulent financial statements aren't the result of lazy accountants, but are actually have a goal, and that is to paralyze Congress. What do you mean by that?
Well, that was actually, I think it was Spinney who said that it's to paralyze Congress. And what it is that Congress can't figure this out. They can't tell what the Pentagon's spending money on. And it's not clear that most of the people in Congress even have the desire to go after the Pentagon ever since 2001, because then you get attacked for not supporting the troops. But it's disturbing to see that even people who you would think would be going after the Pentagon, like, you know, Bernie Sanders or Beto O'Rourke, who is actually on the House Armed Services Committee, don't raise the issue. And I think it's because the Pentagon budget is so bizarre and the numbers are so weird. I think people, and this applies to the media too, which hasn't tried to report on it, I think everybody's intimidated because they think it sounds so freaky that they're going to get accused of, you know, being tinfoil-headed conspiracy theorists.
That was Eric Lindorf. I spoke with him back in December about his article for The Nation, The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed. Find a link at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.